The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Hello, good morning everybody. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call, and it is Friday, December the 10th, 2010. I have been somewhat perplexed over the years, but more particularly in recent months, at how complacent Americans really are about their future. And it's a strange feeling because Europeans, for all their faults, are very much aware of where they stand in the grand scheme of things. But there seems to be a willful ignorance on the part of Americans as to how things play out for them in the overall cycle of progress. And the real explanation, I think, is that Americans are not aware of just how immensely wealthy their country was. It was, frankly, impossible for me in previous talks that I've sort of briefly skirted on this to come up with any real pointers as to how unbelievable the wealth of America used to be. I mean, to the point at which it was incomparable with any other country on earth. I do want to go into this at some point. I don't have time to do it today. But I do think that it's useful to take note of some of the things which represent the horrendous hemorrhaging of America's wealth to foreign countries, which can give you just some window into how much wealth has existed in the United States and how little the lack of that wealth seems to permeate through down to the average man in the street. For example, have you ever seen pictures of the extravagant wealth from places like Dubai or Abu Dhabi and wondered where in the world they got all that money from? Have you ever read news stories that talk about China lending America hundreds of billions of dollars and wondered how they could possibly have so much wealth? Well, actually, it's quite simple. They got most of it from the U.S. Every month, the U.S. buys much more from the rest of the world than the rest of the world buys from the U.S. And that's called the trade deficit, and the United States has been running one for decades. In essence, what is happening each month is that America is transferring somewhere between $40 and $50 billion of its national wealth to the rest of the globe, and they're sending back oil and cheap plastic gadgets that Americans greedily consume. I mean, you don't realize that when little Johnny plays with the toy that he got given for his birthday, that was bought from China, and China received the money for that toy. The money is real, but the toy is ephemeral, because in 3 weeks' time, little Johnny will have finished with his toy, and that'll go into the garbage heap. But China gets to keep the money. You see, in order to maintain America's standard of living, the U.S. government has been going to the countries that it has been sending its wealth to and been begging them to loan back massive amounts of dollars. Now, at this point, the U.S. government literally owes trillions of dollars to the rest of the world. Scoffers say that it's just a bunch of paper money that America is sending them. But it is hundreds of billions of dollars of paper money that's not in the hands of average Americans. And you remember what I told you on Monday. Money is not wealth. Money represents wealth. And that representation of wealth has been transferred and is still being transferred to countries like China every day. And China, bless its heart, is lending that money back to the United States. I mean, America has sent massive amounts of its wealth and prosperity overseas, and it isn't going to come back except by the kindness of strangers who lend it and America borrows it. You know, today there are dozens of U.S. cities such as Detroit, Michigan, and Camden, New Jersey that are turning into post-industrial hellholes, while thousands of gleaming new modern factories are going up all over China. Where do you think that money is coming from? 42.9 million Americans now on food stamps. That's a 16% increase in just 1 year, while the oil sheikhs of the Middle East build opulent palaces that are extravagant beyond belief. Most Americans don't even realize how serious the U.S. addiction to foreign oil really is. The U.S. is constantly being drained of its wealth by these oil powers. And what are they doing with all this money? Well, let's take a look at a couple of examples. Have you ever heard of the Emirates Palace? It's located in the United Arab Emirates, and it cost about $3.8 billion to build. And this is how one writer for a major UK newspaper described it after a visit. The Emirates Palace has so many biggest and best boasts, it could have its own chapter in the Guinness Book of Records. But the atrium is the whistles and bells, the jaw-dropping big daddy of them all. 60 meters high, 42 meters wide, and topped with the largest dome in the world. Staff need golf carts to negotiate their way around it. It is decorated with 13 colors of marble, ranging from sunrise yellow to sunset red, to reflect the many hues of the desert, and lots and lots and lots of gold. 6,040 square meters of gold leaf cover the largest gilded expanse ever created in one building. It's even in the food. I ate gold leaf on my chocolate cake. Apparently it aids digestion. End of quote. In Dubai, there is so much wealth that they pretty much build whatever they can dream up. For example, in Dubai, you will find the largest indoor ski resort in the world. One travel site describes it this way. When one thinks of Arabia, let alone Dubai, one likely pictures an arid desert of heat and sun. One does not think of snow skiing, yet that is what one can do at Ski Dubai, arguably the largest indoor resort in the world. The resort features 22,500 square meters of ski area. The heavily insulated building is kept at 30.2 degrees Fahrenheit during the day and 21.2 degrees Fahrenheit throughout the night, which is when the snow is generated. The resort features 5 ski runs and is open year-round. End of quote. But it isn't just the Middle East that's getting incredibly wealthy off the United States. Over the past 25 years, the trade deficit with China has soared into the stratosphere. In 1985, the trade deficit with China was $6 million for the entire year. In the month of August alone of this year, the U.S. trade deficit with China was over $28 billion. Well, many Americans will find this difficult to comprehend. So for a moment, imagine a giant map of the world, and that there was a giant pile of money in China and a giant pile of money in the United States. Then start taking $20 billion from the pile of the United States and give it to China every single month. After a while, what is going to happen? The United States is going to be a lot poorer and China is going to be a lot wealthier. As Americans have become poorer, it has been harder and harder for them to maintain their very high standard of living. The U.S. government has been borrowing larger and larger sums of money from the rest of the world in order to stimulate the economy. But in the process, the U.S. is piling up horrific amounts of debt. The national debt of the United States is now 13 times larger than it was just 30 years ago. If it did that again over the next 30 years, it would have a national debt of approximately $170 trillion by the year 2040. Now, of course, that will never happen because the entire financial system would collapse and the country would be forced into national bankruptcy long before it ever got into that much debt. The United States of America is already on the verge of total economic collapse. In fact, CNS News is reporting that retiring U.S. Senator George Voinovich believes that the collapse could happen at any time, and I quote, "I think we are on the edge of it right now. I really do. If we don't do something about dealing with the debt and the budgets that aren't being balanced for as far as your eye can see, we are over the cliff. We are on thin ice right now, and I don't think we can wait. We need to move forward. We need to move forward for our own benefit, but we also need to move forward because the world is watching us right now." End of quote. Indeed, the world is watching the U.S., and they are getting tired of financing its runaway debt. Just this week, there have been some very troubling signs. For example, U.S. Treasuries just experienced their biggest two-day sell-off since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The rest of the world was deeply troubled when the Federal Reserve announced another round of quantitative easing. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke had promised that the Fed would not monetize the U.S. government debt, but now that's exactly what is happening. The rest of the world is less than thrilled by this. In addition, many economists are warning that the tax cut deal that Barack Obama and the Republicans have agreed to will increase U.S. government debt even more. In reaction to the deal, economist Nouriel Roubini recently posted the following message on his Twitter account. "Obama GOP tax deal costs $900 billion over 2 years. U.S. kicking the can further down the road. Are bond vigilantes starting to wake up?" End of quote. Well, yes, ladies and gentlemen, they are. In fact, the bond market is collapsing even further today as I speak. That's 14 minutes past 10 on Friday, December the 10th. A recent article on CNBC described what bond vigilantes are. Bond vigilantes, by the way, is a term coined by economist Ed Yardini in the 1980s to describe major investors who demand higher yields to compensate for the perceived risks resulting from large deficits that could derail the country's precarious recovery, according to some economists. Look, the United States government is not going to be able to borrow endless amounts of very cheap money forever. At some point, the U.S. is either going to have to face much higher interest rates on government debt, or the Federal Reserve is going to have to step in and monetize the vast majority of all new government debt. Either alternative will be absolutely disastrous. Most Americans just assume that the wealth and prosperity that they have enjoyed for so many decades will always be with them. But that is not the case. America has been exporting its national wealth and its national prosperity so that Americans could fill up their shopping carts with cheap foreign-made plastic trash and so that they could fill up their cars with foreign oil. It has been a fun ride while it lasted, but with each passing day, a national financial implosion draws ever closer. An economic nightmare is coming. There can be no preventing it at this point. You'd better get ready. And most of you know very well what I mean by that. Okay, let me give you my information. It's Richard Martin here with the Wake Up Call, coming to you live from Singapore through the good offices of PRN in New York City. If you want to call in with questions and your rents, please do, please do. My number is 888-874-4888. That is our toll-free number to the show. Please call in anytime. Again, 888-874-4888. If you'd like to email me, you can, and the email address is rm@gfawd.com. That's GFAWD, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. Once again, the email address, rm@gfawd.com. com. And if you would like to call me in private with your personal questions about your own situation, please feel free to use my direct line for the purpose. It is a Sarasota, Florida number, area code 941-441-1682. Again, that's 941-441-1682. All right, well now, ladies and gentlemen, I feel that it isn't just me that needs to be talking to you. I think you would need to hear some of what I say to you on a regular basis from other people. And I'm going to play you two extended interviews today. The first one comes from David Stockman, and I've mentioned him before. He has had and still has an illustrious business career. He was a member of Congress from 1977 to 81. He was Ronald Reagan's Director of Office of Management and Budget until 1985. And he resigned after the federal debt had nearly doubled under Reagan. He then pursued a successful Wall Street career. He was with Solomon Brothers. He then was with Blackstone Group, and he's been independent since 1999. So here we go. There's an interesting interview with him and Fred Zakaria asking the questions and Stockman giving the answers. So this is an interview with David Stockman and Fareed Zakaria.
When you look at the data, what does the American economy look like now?
I think it's very weak, and I think we're not in any kind of conventional recovery. This isn't just a business cycle. I think we've been through a 30-year binge, if I can use that word, of massive debt creation, both in the public and the household sector. We've had a Fed that's totally changed policy and has become very easy and run the printing press year after year, fueling this enormous current account deficit that we've had. We've basically run $8 trillion worth the deficits with the rest of the world. That is, we're living beyond our means by that extent. And it's cumulatively built up into all kinds of weaknesses in our economy. And so today, we're having a hard time recovering from the big recession that we went through over the last 2 years. And I think this is going to be par for the course, the new normal. Economic growth will be weak as we try to unwind this massive spree that we unfortunately indulged in and reduce the debt on the household sector and on the public sector at some point.
So you're talking about a number of years of fairly poor growth, probably much worse than the current projections.
Yes, I think that's right, and we've never faced that before, because for 40 or 50 years this baby boom generation has always believed that things will get better and better, and they did, and that when we ran into recessions that we could spend our way and borrow our way out of it. Well, we did three or four or five times, but I think when we got to 2008 we were at the end of the road. We had $50 trillion of debt on the public and private sector combined in this economy. We had what would be called a leverage ratio that never before had been seen in history, even during the Great Depression of the 1930s. So we were at a break point. And as a result of that, we're now in an environment where it may take 10 years of very little growth, of difficult struggle to rebalance our economy and bring it back to sustainable health. So we're in a real bind, and I think the budget projections ignore that, and therefore they're way too optimistic.
The Fed and the White House and Congress are all projecting growth rates for next year and the year after that you think are essentially impossible to achieve.
Yes, they're projecting that soon, within a year or two, we'll be back up to 3 or 4% growth. Over the next 5 years, the unemployment rate will come down from 10, or even more if you measure it correctly, where it is today, to 5. That will create 13 million new jobs over the next 5 years, or about 250,000 a month, when since the recession ended in June of 2009, we've barely created 50,000 a month. So the prospect that is likely to happen, I think, is quite remote. And so therefore, if you recalculate the budget with a realistic level of unemployment, and therefore more unemployment spending, more food stamp costs, more safety net costs, and less revenue, the budget deficit will be $100 billion a month as far as the eye can see, and our economy is growing at $50 billion a month at best. So we have a national debt that's growing at twice the rate of our economy, and we have total stalemate in the political process in Washington, as we saw last week in response to the proposal, which I think was pretty constructive, of the two co-chairmen. It was dead on arrival.
Explain that, because you're not just a policy wonk, you were a congressman.
Right.
You were a congressman from Michigan,
right,
which is a tough place to be a congressman from.
Well, we have gone now 30 years with each side sort of digging into their favorite political zone of defense. So now we have the two parties dug in, no spending cuts from the Democratic side, no revenue increases, and in fact, tax cuts from the Republican side, and our system is broken. It is ungovernable fiscally, and at one point or another down the road, the world financial markets, the bond markets, the currency markets are going to figure this out. They're going to figure out that today this crazy QE2 that we have from the Fed is really a disguised form of monetization. Each month the Fed is going to be buying $100 billion worth of new Treasury debt. Each month the Treasury is going to be issuing $100 billion to fund this huge gap. Well, that means that we're just printing money. We're literally printing money to pay the government's bills, and there's no case in history where that's worked for very long.
You say that you are, as an investor, will buy everything that Ben Bernanke cannot destroy.
Yes.
What do you mean? Explain.
Well, I said I would buy gold, maybe I would buy bottled water, canned beans, and some flashlight batteries. It was kind of a statement to say there's a lot of worry about this, and it's not entirely flippant. I think the Federal Reserve is under attack from every corner of the globe, and it should be, from Ron Paul on the right, and he's right, to the Chinese communist leaders who learned their economics from the Little Red Book, and even they can see that printing money in this reckless way, in this magnitude, in an economy where there's too much debt already and the interest rate is zero, what sense does that make?
So paint the scenario you worry about, not a worst case scenario, but a realistic scenario where presumably you feel at some point world markets, world investors will say, wait a minute, can we really rely on the United States to fulfill all these obligations?
Yes, the worry I have is that we're drifting down the road to a global monetary conflagration where this enormous flow of new dollars into the world market creates a huge reaction, and you're seeing it already. Brazil is denouncing it, printing press money, the Chinese, the Germans. So we're running into a dead end here pretty quick. And if a sell-off in the global U.S. government bond market ever gets underway, it'll be, traumatic. It will be a real Armageddon situation. There's $9 trillion out there of U.S. government bonds and bills and notes. And if the world market loses confidence and a sell-off begins, it will really be a traumatic moment.
It will mean that the only way to maintain the system is that the United States, the Federal Reserve, will have to raise interest rates very high, which will then choke off what little growth we have.
Right? Exactly right. Exactly right. They're playing a very dangerous game at the Fed, and they're playing an even more dangerous game in Washington by pretending that, well, the economy is weak. Yes, it is, but it's going to stay weak. And therefore, they're saying, let's wait 2 years and do something. Well, when your credit card is taken away, you don't really tell the credit card company, give me 2 years to see if I can find a couple more jobs so I can pay back my default. So, and this is where we are right now as a nation. We don't have 2 years wait till see if the economy gets a little better before we start making the tough choices to cut spending, defense, Social Security, discretionary spending, and raise taxes. I think it's silly that they're thinking about extending the tax cuts for the richest 2% of Americans in light of the circumstance that we're in. I'm just shocked that Obama wouldn't have the fortitude wouldn't have the insight to realize he has to stare down Congress and say, no, I'm drawing the line in the sand, send me a bill that extends tax cuts for billionaires and I will veto it. And yet, what do you hear? Well, maybe we'll compromise and extend them for a couple years. Unless we get some leadership out of the White House, this situation is going to go from bad to worse very quickly.
We will be back right after this. When we come back, Ronald Reagan's budget director, the architect of the Reagan tax cuts. We're going to talk about what to do now. You say the only solution, logically, is you have to cut spending and raise taxes.
That's
correct. Simply that the hole is too large that you could indulge in the fantasy that you just do one or the other. But part of what you want to do is you're really very comfortable raising taxes substantially on the rich, because you feel that there has been a real divergence in the fate of Americans over the last 25 years.
Yes, because this wasn't a real, solid, sustainable, productivity, technology-based prosperity. Much of this was a debt-fueled money, easy money bubble. In fact, it was a serial bubble, first the dot-com and then the housing and consumer credit and the ATM machine and everybody borrowing from their house in order to buy things they couldn't afford. So all of this ended up, strangely enough, shifting wealth and income to the very top strata of our society in a way that we've never seen in history, because it wasn't real, sustainable, Main Street economic growth and prosperity. One number that I think is shocking is that in 1985, the top 5% of households had $8 trillion of net worth. By the peak of this bubble in 2007, they had $40 trillion.
So from 8 to 40
8
trillion.
To 40, fivefold in 25 years.
And
a
the
30
economy
trillion
didn't,
gain.
And the economy didn't grow fivefold.
And the economy didn't grow fivefold, and it was because of the bubble valuations of assets, stocks and bonds and real estate and all of the other speculative classes.
So you say tax them.
I'm saying that it is now so distorted that to get the economy back to health, we're going to have to reset some basic parameters of our economy, and one of them in this environment would be a higher tax burden on the upper income than a conservative like myself would ordinarily advocate. But right now, this isn't about growth. This isn't about mourning America in 1980. This is about solvency. This is about cleaning up the mess the morning after from a 30-year binge that wasn't sustainable, as we've learned.
And one of the problems at the Republican Party, it seems to me, is, as you say, tax cutting has become a kind of theology. And so that when you bring up the fact that if you do extend the Bush tax cuts, or if you have further tax cuts, you will lose revenue, people say, no, 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 that's not how it works. You know, if we cut taxes, we will get more revenue. Reagan did it, and they often point to the Reagan tax cuts.
Yes, and unfortunately, that was one of the unfortunate legacies of the 1980s that I don't think was really intended. After 1985, the Republican Party adopted the idea that the tax cuts had solved the whole problem, and that, therefore, in the future, deficits didn't matter, and that tax cuts would always be the solution of first, second, and third resort. And I think once that got embedded in a whole generation of new Republican congressmen and senators became drilled in that catechism and then became positioned politically on that proposition, it really led the party out into the wilderness. And then when Dick Cheney, who should have known better, in the 201 debate, I think it was, about the first Bush tax cut, it was totally not needed, said, well, Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. Reagan proved nothing of the kind, and yet that became the mantra, and it just led the Republican Party away from its traditional sound money, fiscal restraint principles that were really the heart of the Republican Party and its job in our system. The Republican Party's job as the conservative party is to be the party that says no, the party of restraint, the party of fiscal responsibility. The others can be the party of dealing with social issues and so forth, and that's necessary as well. But when you have both parties playing the Santa Claus and you have no one willing to spend political capital on fiscal and financial restraint, we end up with the situation we had by 2008.
You're pretty critical of the bailouts themselves. You think that they did a lot of damage. I mean, Warren Buffett says that we should thank the United States. It intervened, saved the system. But you're very concerned about it, and I say, and you say this as a Michigan congressman who voted against the Chrysler bailout.
The first one in 1979, and I think history proved that that was correct. I am strongly opposed to bailouts, but particularly bailouts of Wall Street. And the idea that that the government ought to be thanked, as Mr. Buffett said last week, for the bailouts is just so much humbug. The panic that occurred in September 2008 was not in Main Street America. It wasn't businesses about ready to close their doors because they didn't have cash to meet payroll. That is all urban legend. It's mythology. The panic that was going on was in the fifth floor of the Treasury building. It was in the Eccles building where the Federal Reserve and Bernanke reside. And they created the panic. They stirred up Congress. They were so concerned about where the stock price of Morgan Stanley and Goldman was that they didn't look at the bigger picture. If a couple more banks had gone under, they would have gone under. If the Goldman stock had gone down to $10 and stayed there for a couple years, it wouldn't have been the end of the world. But when we did that, that was the Waterloo for fiscal policy, because how can you ever tell a congressman from Alabama to cut cotton subsidies after you've bailed out every one of the major banks, and not only bailed them out, but within a year they were back to a picture of rosy pink health and paying bonuses, which they will this year, of $144 billion, nearly the highest in history. And I'll never forgive the Bush administration and Paulson for basically destroying the last vestige of fiscal responsibility that we had in the Republican Party. After that, I don't know how we ever make the tough choices.
David Stockman, pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Okay, well, there's one view. As I say, you know, here's a man who's had tremendous experience. He was on clearly one side of the political spectrum, and he's definitely jumped ship. Well, here's somebody else with a very different background, Christopher Whalen, the co-founder and editor of Institutional Risk Analytics, which is a Los Angeles-based provider of risk management tools and consulting services. Chris leads IRA's risk advisory practice. He consults for global companies on a variety of financial and regulatory issues. He's been hailed by Nouriel Roubini as one of the leading independent analysts of the U.S. banking system. Over the past two decades, he has appeared before the U.S. Congress and the Securities and Exchange Commission to testify on a variety of financial issues, such as the interactive data, investing, and free trade. Mid-1984, he was hired as a management trainee by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where he worked in the bank supervision and foreign exchange departments, and subsequently worked in the fixed income department of Bear Stearns in London. After returning to the United States in 1988, he spent a decade providing risk management and loan workout services to multinational companies and government agencies operating in Latin America. During this period, he was actively involved in the pro-democracy movement in Mexico and served as advisor to the presidential campaign of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas Solórzano. So here's a man eminently qualified to speak and to say the things that he is about to tell you, ladies and gentlemen. So listen in, and again, this is Chris Whalen of Institutional Risk Analytics.
Welcome to Money News on Newsmax TV. I'm Kathleen Walter. Joining us is writer and investment banker Christopher Whalen, the co-founder of Institutional Risk Analytics, which provides services for auditors, regulators, and financial professionals. He also edits the Institutional Risk Analyst, a weekly commentary on the institutions and financial markets that comprise the global political economy. He is the author of the new book, Inflated, How Money and Debt Built the American Dream. Welcome back to Newsmax TV, Christopher.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Unemployment seems to be heading back up over the medium term, perhaps to over 10%. What's the solution here?
Well, the solution is that we have to cut back public spending, and we have to restructure some insolvent banks, especially the top four. You're not going to get any growth in credit as long as we let the big zombie banks muddle along. You know, the Keynesians are coming out of the woodwork. They're saying, oh, no, we've got to spend more, we've got to borrow more. But the truth of the matter is that as long as we let the public sector get bigger, we're going to kill the private sector. That's the trade-off. So I think we've got to hold our ground. The Republicans have to insist on keeping the tax cuts in place, but they've got to go and cut spending, Kathleen. That's the tough part for the Republicans. They're good at tax cuts, but they've got to get really tough on fiscal issues.
Now, WikiLeaks is said to be targeting Bank of America next. What damaging information do you think WikiLeaks could have on the financial powerhouse?
Well, I don't think there's anything that we don't know. They may have some interesting documents that we could look at, but I think we really understand what the problem is with Bank of America. They're insolvent. They still have huge amounts of losses to take on their mortgage book, on their balance sheet, and they also have to deal with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, everybody else who wants them to buy back defaulted mortgages, which is going to be extremely expensive. The head of Freddie Mac, incidentally, testified before Congress this week, and he said that the accumulation of foreclosures and the delay in processing these defaulted loans is costing him hundreds of millions of dollars a month. So you can just imagine what's going on at Bank America, which is about the same scale of an operation in terms of mortgage servicing. We've got to get to the point where we understand that the only way we can have a bank like Bank America extend credit to private sector borrowers, consumers, business, is to restructure the bank. And luckily, we have the authority with Dodd-Frank. The problem is that neither President Obama nor Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are willing to do the hard work. They just want to basically tread water and hope that the problem goes away, but it's not going to go away.
Now, you touched on foreclosures. The flood of foreclosures over the past year has started to clear the courts. How much longer do you think that this housing crisis is going to last?
Well, it's going to peak next year. We're not nearly a third of the way through the backlog of foreclosures, in part because the banks operationally just couldn't deal with it. You also have to remember that from the time that a bank actually forecloses on a home to the point where they have a clear title to the property and they can sell it is well over a year. So all of the foreclosures that are happening this year, we're not going to see them moving through the system and finally seeing those houses sold in involuntary sales, as they're called, until sometime this time next year, maybe even 2012. So if you look at the conference call that Bank of America had for the third quarter earnings, they talk about this at the end in some detail. They're talking about ramping up their capacity to deal with their own backlog of foreclosures by this time next year. So that tells you really in an operational sense where these banks see the peak, if you will, of the problem. My big concern, by the way, Kathleen, is that by next year, most of the home sales in the United States are going to be involuntary. They're going to be the result of foreclosures, and this is going to pull down all of the comparable prices for homes that are still performing as far as their mortgages are concerned. So I think we have an enormous problem here, and unfortunately the Obama administration, as Mayor Bloomberg said the other day, does not have the people around the president who can give him good advice on this, and I feel very badly. I didn't support Barack Obama, but I don't want to see him fail. You know, we only have one president at a time, and we do not have time to mess around with this.
All right, to another issue. You have predicted that California will default on its debt. Is there no other fate for that state? And are there any other big states or big cities on the edge of default?
Well, they're all heading in the same direction, Kathleen. I sit on the advisory board of my little village here in New York, and, you know, we all have the same problem, which is that mandates, pensions, everything else are going up 4%, 5%, 6% a year, but revenues are flat, so they're going down. Now, if you look at the employment number we had today, which was very poor, you have to ask yourself, in the case of California, sales taxes, property taxes are the two major sources of revenue for the state. What if we have a down economy next year and we have down real estate prices, I think you're going to see a situation where the accumulation of foreclosures is going to start hurting property tax revenues for cities and counties, and that is going to just snowball. Because remember, when the house is foreclosed, nobody's paying the property taxes. The bank isn't going to pay the property taxes. They're going to wait till the property is sold. And then the new buyer pays practically nothing for the house, and they have to clear the tax arrears. So if you look at New York, California, Illinois, there's probably another half dozen states behind them. They all have basic imbalances between revenue and the obligations that they have. And not just this year, Kathleen. You got to think of this as a multi-year problem, because if we don't go into these situations and start cutting programmatic spending, then we're never going to get ahead of the curve in terms of making revenue and their expenses meet. In fact, I will tell you that I think you're going to see, both in Europe and the United States, a whole series of sovereign defaults or near defaults, for the simple reason that we don't have the growth that everybody thought we were going to have.
Chris, some Republicans have warned that the Fed's QE2 policy will lead to runaway inflation. Others are fearing deflation. What do you see as the biggest threat to the U.S.?
Well, we have both. You have deflation in many price sectors. You certainly have deflation in the employment side of the economy. But prices are going up for most necessities. If you go to the grocery store, I do the shopping in my family, I don't see any prices falling. If anything, retailers are trying hard. They're using incentives, all sorts of efforts to drive sales. But, I think, well, unfortunately, we're going to have to live with both. Until we get the Congress to understand that they can't borrow money forever and that they have to start addressing fiscal issues, I think the only alternative is inflation. And unfortunately, in a political sense, I talk about this in my book, that's always been the default in the United States, going back to Abraham Lincoln, in fact. So we need to understand that inflation is an important part of how our country got to where it is today, but it's also killing us. Because, if you think of the Bush tax cuts, for example, they were an effort to stimulate growth, but they really didn't address the medium term, the long term issue, which was the ability of this economy to generate jobs, generate wealth in a real sense. So while we had nominal growth for the last 20 years, for example, we're not really keeping up in real terms if you look at it on an inflation adjusted basis.
An increasing number of economic indicators suggest the U.S. economy will enter a period of long-term recovery during the second half of 2011. So why do banks still face such a troubled future?
Well, it's because they have been trying to deal with their problems sequentially. If you think of it each quarter, they're only admitting to as much bad loans, other expenses, as they have income to cover it. The Fed's QE2, the low interest rate environment, is essentially a subsidy for the banks. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are also providing subsidies to the banks because they've increased the spread or the profit on a mortgage when it's originated. But all of that having been said, you still don't really, I believe, see a catalyst for a rebound next year. I don't understand how economists can go on about a sustainable recovery when we have zero interest rates. When we get interest rates back up to a normal level, maybe 1-2% for short-term funds, and then we can see economic growth, then I think we've got something to hold on to. But right now, I'm very skeptical about those predictions of a bounce next year, especially given the housing market, Kathleen. If home prices are falling again next year because of the bulk of foreclosures moving through the system, I think it's going to be very hard to get positive growth.
Chris, among the big U.S. banks, which one do you feel is in the worst shape and why?
Well, Bank of America, because of their mortgage exposure, they have over $2 trillion in loans that they sold to third parties, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, private investors. All of these investors are now demanding that Bank of America buy back those loans. My estimate through the cycle for Bank of America for that expense alone is about $50 to $60 billion. That's half of their tangible common equity. But then if you look at other areas, commercial exposures, their own balance sheet where they do retain a lot of loans, their home equity lines, which is $110 billion alone, you would cut that in half if you were going to market to market today. So I think Bank of America is going to have to be restructured. I think the bondholders at Bank of America specifically are going to have to be compelled to convert into equity. And then we can clean up that bank. That's the good news. If we restructure the bank, you turn debt into equity, you cut their expenses, you charge off a bunch of bad loans, and the bank is solvent. the bank can make loans and grow from that point. And that's what we want. We want to see balance sheets expanding because right now, Kathleen, the whole industry is shrinking, and that's really bad for the U.S. economy.
Chris, have any big U.S. banks dramatically improved this year?
Yes, actually. Our third quarter ratings are fairly hopeful. The smaller banks, people like U.S. Bank Corp, BB&T, some of the larger regionals are showing very significant improvement. But that's because they've had to do the hard work, and they've also had less exposure to Wall Street, mortgage-backed securities, all this exotic stuff that caused the big guys such problems. So there's two sides of the story. The community banks, even some of the medium-sized regional banks are improving. In fact, they've been improving for three quarters. But the big guys, I think, still have some profound problems.
Well, Ireland's banks are the latest to need a bailout. In your view, have they been saved? And where do you think the next bank trouble spot is outside the U.S.?
Oh, no. The Irish have not been saved. We're going to see how this evolves in January when they elect a new government. My sense is that the Germans are in behind the scenes getting ready to start haircutting bondholders and even depositors. If you look at the new deposit insurance regime that's going to be put in place in Ireland, it's pretty clear to me that some of the larger depositors at Anglo-Irish Bank are going to take losses. This has to happen. You know, we don't have the money to paper over all the problems in Europe because Ireland is small. Wait till we get to Spain. Spain is a disaster. Their banking system had the same crazy mania in real estate that we saw here in the U.S. I mean, Spain is the Florida of Europe. Think of it that way. And as a result, they have profound asset quality problems. And the French and the Germans own the bonds of the Spanish banks. So this is going to be a very difficult process we're going to see the Europeans going through. But we shouldn't laugh because we have the same problems. And whoever bites the bullet and does the right thing first, I think, is going to come out of this first.
Chris, you're so fantastic with trends. Are there any other trends or warning signs that you feel that investors should know about?
Well, I think we're starting to see interest rates move up. If you look at the 10-year, if you look at corporate bonds, especially mortgage-backed securities that are not on the Fed's menu for this latest round of asset purchases, the Fed is just buying Treasury bonds this time. They're trying to keep short-term rates low. But everything else, you see the spreads widening. So I think investors are starting to get more cautious in terms of interest rates. And if rates go up, then the stock market's going to go down. The only thing that's been keeping equities where they are today is the fact that we have almost no return on fixed income investments. So people go into stocks because it's the only place they can go and because it's liquid. You know, the funny part for me as a owner of a bank rating agency is that people don't buy the good banks because they're small and they're relatively illiquid. They buy Citigroup, they buy Bank America because these are big stocks and they can move large amounts of money in and out. But I think you're going to see rates move higher next year, and that's going to really put pressure on all of the economies in the industrialized world.
All right, Christopher Whalen, thanks so much for joining us. As always, we appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And thank you for watching Money News on Newsmax TV.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoyed that. I don't usually do that, but I felt that it was important for you to hear the voice of somebody else, preferably coming from your part of the world. So there you have it, two very eminent gentlemen giving their points of view. All right, so on the line now we have Zaid, and he has a message for you, I believe. Hello, Zaid, are you there?
Hi, Richard. How you doing?
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so basically, one thing that I would like to do is I would like to talk a little bit more with the other listeners. So I went ahead and I created a Google group, and if people want to join up on it, they can go ahead and send me an email. Is it okay if I give out my personal email address? Or?
As far as I'm concerned, it is. It isn't. I mean, I guess you'll be beeped out, but yeah, go ahead and see what happens.
Yeah, so basically it's... zaid.hisham@gmail.com. So it's basically my name, zaid.hisham@gmail.com. So again, that's Z as in zebra, aid.hisham@gmail.com.
Okay, well, that's it. That's why don't you give out the first bit again? What was the site? Zaid, just be a little bit slower and enunciate clearly. Go ahead.
Yeah, so people should just email me personally at my personal email. So it's zaid.hisham@gmail.com.
And tell me again what it is.
Yes, so I made a basically a wake-up call forum on Google Groups, basically. And so I would really like to talk to the other people like Jack and like Steve, because I really think we could, I think I have a lot to learn from all the people that call in, all the great people that call in. And I think it would be great
very good
to share what everybody
thank
is.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okie doke.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Zaid, and good luck. Hope the thing takes off for you.
Thank you. Okay. Appreciate it.
All right. Well, here let's have a look at a couple of emails. I got an email from Steve Kruger, who's turned into a knowledgeable expert on matters pertaining to WikiLeaks and Mr. Assange. And I believe that Steve has discovered the root of the problem and the solution. And he says as follows, Richard, I do think the internet is being set up to have a thick woolen sock shoved down its piehole. Assange is not that bright. The charges of rape were brought against him because he had sex with two girls at two different times, and the girls knew each other. When they compared notes, they filed charges. They have no case. They are just pissed. It should be interesting to watch this play out. Steve Kruger. And Steve then got so excited and he got so inspired that he wrote me a second email saying, Richard, Nero only played the fiddle while Rome burnt. The Bernanke, in true addicted gambler fashion, when he is on a losing streak, he doubles his bet. He only digs the hole deeper. Steve Kruger. Well, there you have it. That's Steve and his words of wisdom. I got a very nice note from John Dusmanis, who says, Hi, Richard. Just a quick note to thank you for your well-researched program content on your wake-up call. Best wishes to you and your wife for a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Keep up the good work. You have commented more than once on the American people not doing anything while everything they value is being taken from them. Yes, the Republic of the People and the freedoms it granted has indeed been taken over by the corporations. Pay close attention to Santa's bell that says it all. Sincerely, John Dusmanis. And then Mike Ridinger also wrote in with a nice email saying, Richard, I'm listening to the archives and you are addressing the weakness of the European Union which brought about the euro. I'm curious, what is your insight about why the British pound is still a viable currency but all of the other member countries had to decouple from their home currency? Keep up the great work. Look forward to your answer on Friday. Well, the British, pound isn't really a viable currency. It just happens to be the best of a bad lot. It's pretty much like the United States currency is right now, which is why it's going up. Britain is just lucky. It didn't join the euro, so it's able to manipulate its economy around its currency, which, of course, the euro countries cannot do. The other member countries decoupled from their home currency by choice. They felt they wanted to become a part of a European group. They were sold a bill of goods by all the euro people, and it didn't work out for them too much, did it? So anyway, unfortunately, they're going to suffer, and Britain is also going to suffer, but for really very, very different reasons. All right, so I think it's time for me to give you perhaps one more email, and then I shall sound you out with a familiar name. This comes from Kevin Sierra. He says, Richard was reading an article earlier in the week which was discussing inflation in China and America's desire to have China's renminbi revalued higher. In the article, the analyst said the way inflation is going in China, soon there will be not a need to revalue the renminbi because wages in China are going up so fast. That made me think of the high inflation in the U.S. in the 1970s that drove up wages and made manufacturing in the U.S. uncompetitive with the rest of the world. Could a similar situation be developing in China where its manufacturing costs get too high? with the risk of increased unemployment this would bring, I can't imagine the Chinese government allowing something like this to happen. Any thoughts appreciated? Kevin Sierra, West Milford, New Jersey. Okay, well, basically China is in a problem because it will have nobody to sell things to. It's a little bit different from America in the 1970s, but China is going to have a bust just because there is no consumers to take its products, but then I think China will just do fine. So I don't think it's a question of inflation at this point. I think it's a question of deflation and China basically having to bring down its costs in line with its newly found position. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, it's been good to talk to you, and I shall leave you with John Stewart and his rendition of the Bernanke problem. Talk to you on Monday. Have a wonderful weekend.
That's right. We're still talking about it. Our economy has been guided by the Federal Reserve Bank, which is now engaged in a trillion-plus dollar program to prop up the economy called quantitative easing. It's not a made-up phrase, if that's what you're thinking. It's when the Fed buys up government debt with money that they make out of thin air. Sounds like they're printing money. Nuh-uh.
One myth that's out there is that what we're doing is printing money. We're not printing money.
See? That's Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed. We're not printing money. We're imagineering money. Printing money would be like last year when we were making things quantitatively easier for banks by buying up massive amounts of their debt using money created from thin air. That was printing money. Don't take my word for it. Take the guy with the exact same beard on the exact same show talking to the exact same interviewer not 21 months ago.
To lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. So it's much more akin, although not exactly the same, but it's much more akin to printing money than it is to borrowing.
You've been printing money.
Well, effectively, and we need to do that.
I guess Bernanke was looking at the average age of a 60 Minutes viewer and betting anyone who saw him last year is dead now. Just admit it, Bernanke. You're a guy with a beard who's allowed to print money, which makes you look smarter and more powerful than people who can't print money and don't have beards. Frankly, I tried growing a beard. My power, if anything, diminished. It's the ability to print money. That's the thing. So go ahead then, print money. Aside from Zimbabwe-like hyperinflation, what could go wrong?
A printing problem has forced the government to put more than 1 billion brand new $100 bills into storage. Production has been halted until a fix is figured out.
Are you f***ing me? Now we can't even print money? That was the last thing we were good at. What happened?
Apparently the printing process, which incorporates high-tech features like 3D security strips, color-shifting images, is so complex that it's causing bills to crease and fold during production.
Oh, my God. We've outsmarted ourselves with our own fancy security measures to the point where our money is committing suicide on the press. I hope we still remember our passwords, or at least the answers to the security question prompts. Ooh, what's our country's maiden name? Great Britain, I believe. So apparently the only way to fix the economy is to print money, but we can't print money. The only way this story could get worse is if it somehow also added to global warming.
It will take more than a year to sift through those piles of cash and find the bad bills, which will be taken out and burned.
In outdoor fires in front of homeless people.